Du noch gleich wieder.
Hallo.
Hallo.
Ich muss den Lautsprecher von deinem.
Hallo.
Good morning.
Morning.
No, good
evening.
Hello, Rebel Phil.
Hello.
Morning. Happy birthday to you. Und so weiter. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Happy, happy, happy birthday. Long time.
Happy belated birthday.
It's getting to be lots of numbers these days. I'm not yet 100, though, so. Okay, I'm sorry about last week. I was so involved in translating that I totally forgot. I didn't even have Skype on, so that's why I didn't answer.
The translation group is very grateful for a week of more time.
That's good. So there was some benefit from that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're on class 5, right?
Yep.
Class 5. Okay. So let's go. The topic today is omniscience, what it cannot be and what it is. And we're going to be using the terms changing and unchanging a lot in this class. What German terms have you come up with for those?
Veränderlich und unveränderlich. It's very near with the English words.
Okay, okay. It's hard to find words for these. They have to be explained and then you understand them. I think the same thing was true with Tibetans. Because, you know, the Tibetan language is the language of sheep and yak herders, not very sophisticated, even though it became the language for probably the highest philosophical discourse the planet's ever had. They just raised things to very new heights using this very simple language. Anyhow, there's a Tibetan word, Takpa, which means unchanging, in the sense that a thing does not change moment to moment. An unchanging thing is not caused, and it does not perform a function. And examples of unchanging things are empty space and emptiness, the fact that nothing has a nature of its own. Empty space refers to really unobstructive space. You're sitting in a chair right now or on the floor or something, and you are occupying space. And the space that you're occupying is unobstructive, which allows you to be able to sit where you are. And that's the idea of space. That space does not change. It is the same thing, whether you are in it or not. It's unobstructive. When you're in it, it's not obstructive because you're in it. When you're not in it, it's unobstructive, even though there's nothing there in it. Now, moment to moment has to do with the fact that things change 64 times in the duration of a finger snap. That's what moment-to-moment means. A thing comes into existence, it lasts, it goes out of existence, and comes back into existence. It keeps doing that 64 times a second. So an unchanging thing is something that does not do that. Now, changing and unchanging things are divisions of what we call existence, things that exist. The Buddhist universe is composed of things that are known as selfless. meaning they don't have a separate sort of self-controlling self. And selfless is divided into changing things and unchanging things. Everything that exists, meaning everything that can be known by a valid consciousness, is either changing or it's unchanging. There's no other possibility. Now, Tathpa was originally translated into English as permanent, and you'll see that translation in a lot of English-written books about Buddhist philosophy. The problem with this translation is that permanent has the sense of lasting forever, in English anyway. Now, it is true that if something is permanent, it probably doesn't change at all. That's true. But unchanging things don't necessarily last forever. The emptiness of your mind, for example, will go out of existence when you die. And the mind I'm talking about here is what we call the gross mind. It's your awareness. You know, you're aware of what's going on right now. It's that mind that we call the gross mind. The gross mind is dependent upon your body. Now, you have a subtle mind, and you have a very subtle mind as well. We're talking about the proof of future lives in this course. So if the gross mind goes out of existence when you die, what's this thing about future lives? Well, it's the very subtle mind that goes on from life to life to life. And that very subtle mind is the basis then of the subtle mind and the gross mind that we have in various existences when we are reborn. Unchanging things don't necessarily last forever, though, like the emptiness of the mind. The emptiness of a teacup, for example, comes into existence when the teacup is made, and it goes out of existence when the teacup is destroyed. So while the emptiness of a teacup is in existence, it is unchanging, meaning that it does not change moment to moment. So in our immediate tradition, we use the term unchanging as opposed to something like permanent, unchanging. So, and then Tathpa is unchanging. Mitakpa means changing thing. It was originally translated into English as impermanent. And this translation in English isn't so bad in the sense that it doesn't really create a misunderstanding of the term mitakpa. It does give the sense that something doesn't last forever. Now, people who were really picky about things could say that the emptiness of a teacup is impermanent, meaning that it doesn't last forever. But that's not understanding this idea of a thing changing from moment to moment. In our tradition, our immediate tradition, meaning the Diamond Mountain tradition, we're using the term changing to translate the word mitakpa, and you have an equivalent word in German to do that. Changing does get across the idea that things change. And then we simply extend that to change moment to moment, meaning that any changing thing changes 64 times in the duration of a finger snap. Now, what does this have to do with omniscience? Meaning, what is omniscience, really? So we're going to go through some background in ancient India about ideas of omniscience. There was a philosophical school in ancient India called the Charvakas. and they agreed with the fact that there was an omniscient being. But then they said that an omniscient being could only be the creator of the world. So in their view, omniscience is accompanied by being the creator of the world. You cannot be omniscient without being the creator of the world. Omniscience and creator of the world go together. Now, the Charvaka's understanding of omniscience was the same as Buddhists, you know, meaning that an omniscient being is a being that knows all things at the same time, at one time. But then they went on to say that this omniscient creator being was Takpa, or unchanging. They said that from this being flows all things. That being knows all things, and that being made the world, and that being is unchanging. Now, this was a strange idea to Buddhists. So Dharmakirti said, let's take a look at this more carefully. When we talk about an omniscient being or omniscience, we are actually talking about a mind. Now, a mind has five aspects or qualities. A mind, when it perceives something, takes on the aspect of the object it is perceiving. When you look at blue, for example, your mind gets a little blue, meaning that it takes on the aspect of blue. It's like when you put something blue in front of a mirror, you know, the mirror becomes blue. The mirror is not stained with blue, but as long as the blue object is in front of the mirror is blue. The blue quality of the object is reflected as a quality of the mirror. And the mind operates in the same way. When it perceives an object, it takes on the qualities of an object. You know, it reflects those qualities. Now, the Tibetan term for this quality of the mind is nampa. And nampa means aspect or quality. There are some schools in Tibet that think that if you figure out how nampa works, then you can perceive emptiness. And they spend years meditating on the mind and how it takes the form of the object it perceives. They think that this is meditating on the ultimate nature of the mind. And this is wrong. It is not the ultimate nature of the mind. You know, it is the conventional nature of the mind. And meditating on this quality of the mind is instructive for us, but it is not the ultimate nature of the mind. And therefore, that kind of meditation does not produce causes for perceiving emptiness directly, let alone nirvana or omniscience, becoming the Buddha. Now, if the object a mind is perceiving is a changing thing, then what's the quality of that mind? Well, one of the qualities of that mind is that it is a changing thing. Why? Because the mind reflects the object it is perceiving. If the object is unchanging, the mind is unchanging. Now, the ancient schools, like the Charvakas, held that the omniscient mind was an unchanging thing. And if that was true, then that mind could not be characterized by wisdom. Why? Because wisdom is a changing thing. Now, Dharmakirti makes the argument that since an omniscient mind focuses on all things, past, present, and future, and those things are mostly changing things, then an omniscient mind must be a changing thing. It cannot be an unchanging thing. Now, what happens when a mind perceives an unchanging thing? Well, you would think that that mind is an unchanging thing. a mind perceiving an unchanging thing, we would think, would be an unchanging thing. But Dharmakirti says that that is not necessarily so. A mind focusing on an unchanging object, you know, like empty space or emptiness, that mind engages the object and then withdraws from it. And that indicates that that mind is not an unchanging thing. Its object is unchanging, but the mind itself is not. So Master Dharmakirti has two arguments here. The first one is that an omniscient mind is a changing thing because most of what it perceives are changing things. And the second argument is a mind perceiving an unchanging thing is still a changing thing itself because it engages and it disengages the unchanging thing. So in the first argument, Master Dharmakirti is focusing on the quality of the object, which is changing. And that quality is what determines the quality of the mind, meaning a changing thing. In the second argument, he steps back from that reasoning and focuses on the activity of the mind. And the activity of the mind is engaging and disengaging. Now, it does that for a changing thing as well. But for an unchanging thing, it engages and disengages the unchanging thing, and therefore the mind is changing. Now, we have to deal with the part of the Charvaka's assertion, you know, that an unchanging creator made the world. And there are also many other schools besides the Charvakas that assert that. The Judeo-Christian Islam world asserts the same thing. Maybe. We'll talk about that. Now, there's a quote in scripture, the world is made in stages. And that understanding, that quotation, probably matches our own experience. You know, we would have to assume that an unchanging creator being would make the universe and everything in it instantaneously. Why would we assume that? Well, if the world was made in stages, then the unchanging creator being wouldn't be unchanging because he would do one thing and then something else and then something else and then something else. You know, think of the 7-day creation of the world in Genesis. Why would an omnipotent creator... Okay, we have to distinguish now between omniscient and omnipotent. Omniscient means understanding everything, everywhere, at the same time. There isn't a cubic centimeter in the universe that an omniscient mind does not perceive, past, present, and future. An omnipotent being would be a creator being. An omnipotent being can do anything and everything at will, meaning an omnipotent being performs a function. And, yeah, right, it does something. Therefore, it cannot be an unchanging thing. But I'm getting ahead here. We would have to assume that an unchanging creator being would create the entire universe in one instant. It would just pop into existence, and that would be it. But our experience is that things unfold in the world. The world happens in stages. You know, and it's kind of insulting to our experience for somebody to claim that the universe was created in a single moment, because that is not our experience, right? Now, we have to think about what created means here. You know, we assume, scientists sort of figure that the universe is 6.5 billion years old. But the Earth itself is much less than that. And the earth wasn't created really until the sun got going, and so on. And then when we fix our dinner, which you've just done, we had to spend some time and do some time for that dinner to come into existence. Now, our world is all the things that we experience. So if the world was made in an instant, boom, by an omnipotent, unchanging creator being, then whatever it became at that point, it would always have been and will always continue to be. Meaning that we would never have been born. Meaning that you could never have fixed dinner for yourself. So forth and so forth and so forth. Is our world changing? Yes. The entire Sierra Nevada mountain range in the eastern part of the state of California is rising at the rate of 6 feet per century. The Himalayas are also rising right now. They are getting taller and taller and taller. We also know that the sea level is rising. We also know that the sea level was much lower than it once was during the Ice Age, for example. The world, our world is constantly changing. We eat three times a day. We go to sleep at night. We get up in the morning. We go to work. We talk. We are constantly changing. Our world is constantly changing. With our arguments now against our opponent who insists that the Creator is an unchanging thing, that our opponent now modifies his argument to say that, in fact, the omniscient Creator being does change over time, meaning that he's sometimes wrathful, sometimes compassionate, sometimes jealous, and so on. And we can read about this creator being in the Old Testament. This omniscient creator being, however, has always been an omniscient creator being. This is the assertion of our opponent here. There was never a time when he changed from not being an omniscient creator being to being an omniscient creator being. And Dharmakirti says that that is not possible. There has to be some cause to make your omniscience, if you're an omniscient creator being. He goes on to say that a being who has been omniscient and omnipotent for all time has never suffered and has never had anything good happen to him or her. Therefore, that omniscient creator being cannot be omniscient. An unchanging, omniscient being has never traveled the path and therefore cannot teach the path. And you can extend these arguments, but the bottom line is that when you are done with all of this, is that such an unchanging, omniscient creator being cannot exist. The end of the third chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha, it's the treasure house of knowledge, discusses various ideas of where the world comes from. And this idea of an unchanging omniscient creator being is one of the ideas presented there. Now, it's crucial that you get a good feeling for how your world was created or is being created. Success in Tantra depends on that. We've been brought up in a society that asserts a creator being as the creator of the world. You know, whether you believe that or not, you've been brought up to think that way. So someplace in your mind is that idea. That idea goes through everything that we do. It pervades the way that we think. At some level, it does that. So it's important that we develop a well-grounded understanding as to why this is impossible. It's not enough to say, I don't believe that. All right? I mean, you've probably all said that at some point, or at least, well, I don't think that's true, you know. But it's not enough to do that. You've got to reason it out for yourself and understand at a deep level that that kind of omniscient creator being is not possible. It's also important to not put down other people's beliefs regarding this, okay? If you do that, that is not a path to either nirvana or to enlightenment. So we must not do that. We have two bodhisattva vows regarding that, that you break your vows if you do something like that. It's okay for us to begin to question that belief and then to reject it through logic and do it deeply. But it's not okay for us to ruin somebody else's belief that they're hanging on to. That doesn't mean we can't debate them, but we just can't destroy their beliefs by saying, that's not so, and you're stupid for believing that. Now, as we do our practice, we have to consider two things. One of the things is things that we should take up, and the other one is things that we should give up. And we have to establish a definite line between those two things. We don't really know the difference between these two things right now. You know, the line is fuzzy. But if we had a definite idea of which things are the things that we should take up and which things are the things that we should give up, our lives would change. So what are some things that we should give up? For example, desire for wealth or fame, hope for lasting love in this life. In general, things which are impossible to get or impossible to maintain once you get them. Those are what we should give up. And when we talk about desire for wealth, it's this ignorant desire. All right, it's the thing that says that being wealthy has nothing to do with the way that I treat others. That's the ignorant desire. And if you want wealth or fame or food or sex or whatever, with this ignorant desire, those are things that we have to give up. What are things that we should take up? Well, one of them is sacrificing ourselves in order to help others. You know, putting other people before us. The things that we should take up are helping others. Others are more important than me. Now, there's only one being that knows these things perfectly, and that is a Buddha. And Master Dharmakirti says that that is why a Buddha is omniscient, meaning that it isn't enough to know every rock at the bottom of every ocean in the universe or to know every bug crawling around everywhere in the universe. What makes a being omniscient is knowing clearly and perfectly what things are beneficial, meaning the things that we should take up, and what things are detrimental to us, meaning things that we should give up. And that is what qualifies a being as an omniscient being. Now, as to our practice, many of the things we should take up or avoid are covered in our vows. The things we should take up are also known as the pure side of existence. There's a pure side of existence and an impure side of existence. So the things that we should take up are known as the pure side of existence. It is important to know. It is important for us to know why we are keeping our vows. Why should I not criticize others? Why should I develop a mind that cherishes others? Why should I avoid intoxicants? When you understand these things, rather than just blindly following the rules, you make great progress on the path. Now, if you went to Sunday school or to synagogue, You know, you were taught the Ten Commandments, but probably not taught why. Why should we not kill? Why should we not steal? Why should we not commit adultery? And so on. But we aren't taught those things. You know, saying that, well, because they're not nice, that's not a reason. In Buddhism, we have to understand the whys of all of those things. And when we understand why we're keeping whatever vows we have, then we make progress. If you simply don't criticize others or don't commit adultery without understanding why, you're not going to make any progress on the path. You have to have the wisdom in order to make keeping the vows work for you. So the things that we should take up are the pure side of existence. Okay, the impure side of existence is our mental afflictions. In general, our bodies are the result of mental afflictions. You know, aches and pains and so forth are explicit results of our mental afflictions. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all the disturbances in the Middle East, all the civil wars in Africa are the results of our own mental afflictions. And we're going to talk more about this later. So, now that we know a little better about what an omniscient being is, how do we check out whether a particular candidate for omniscient being speaks the truth? You know, meaning that he's perfectly correct. So we covered this in our last class. The first thing that Lord Buddha taught was the four truths of Aryas. And he taught this to the five ascetics that he'd spent a number of years with meditating. He said that our existence is characterized by suffering, and he described three types of suffering. Now, when we first encounter these teachings, if we examine our experience honestly, we understand that what he has said matches our experience. You know, there is nothing in our experience that invalidates what Lord Buddha taught. So what were the three types of suffering that he explained? The suffering of suffering, which is physical or mental pain. And we've experienced that, right? The second kind of suffering is the suffering of change, meaning that every good thing we ever experience goes away. And that is the suffering. We like being happy, but what we're happy about evaporates within a few minutes. And that's the suffering. It is also true that suffering itself, the suffering of suffering, goes away after a while. That's true. And the third kind of suffering was what he called all-pervasive suffering, meaning that everything in our lives is tainted with a seed that causes us to see things incorrectly, and that itself is a suffering, and it's what leads to the other kinds of suffering. And if we think about it, that's, you know, that does match our experience. His teaching about the truth of suffering, we understand. And then the next thing he said is that there is a cause for that suffering. That cause is our mental afflictions. And the mental afflictions are fueled by ignorance. And if we think about it, we understand that this is true too, based on our experience. You know, based on what we've covered in the first four classes and the other classes that you've gone through, we're beginning to understand that our mental afflictions come from ignorance. We know that. It's based on our experience. So here again, Lord Buddha appears to be speaking the truth to us. And then he said that if there is a cause for suffering and we remove that cause, our suffering will also be removed. And this we can accept through logic. You know, it doesn't take a lot of effort. If our suffering has a cause, meaning based on things that we do, if we stop doing those things, the suffering will go away. And finally, he taught that there is a method by which we can remove our suffering. And this part we take on faith until we've tried it a bit and begin to experience the results. But mostly we're concerned here with the first truth, that our lives are characterized by suffering. Our lives are permeated with suffering. And part of this teaching is that of mitakpa, you know, of unchanging, of changing things. Suffering is a changing thing. Lord Buddha extended his teaching on this to say that the destruction of things starts when they begin. So a thing cannot last for a long time. In addition, at a subtle level, things cannot survive even for a moment after they are created before they disintegrate. And I've said before, the Tibetan word for world is jikten, which means basis for destruction. So as we understand this teaching, and as we affirm that it confirms to our own experience, we gain confidence that this is a true teaching and that an omniscient being speaks the truth. The second truth, that there is a cause for our suffering, is expanded in the teaching on karma. The opening lines of chapter 4 of the Abhidharma Kosha, Lele Jitta Natsoke, Dene Sempa, Dang Deje, which means all the various worlds come from karma, the things that we do. And karma is a movement of the mind and what that inspires in us. So this world that we experience comes from what we think and do. And the source of our suffering is what we think or do. If we accept a creator being, we probably won't accept this part, you know, the part that our world comes from us, that our suffering comes from us. Or at least we won't accept the part that we create our world. So if we create our suffering, we can also create the end to our suffering. You know, note now that the end of suffering isn't necessarily happiness. It's just the absence of suffering. But according to these two lines, then, we can also create our own happiness. If the world comes from what we do, and our suffering comes from what we do, then our happiness itself can come from what we do. It's just that we have to do different things for that. So how do we accept that an omniscient being speaks the truth? We experience, you know, directly that people die, for example. You know, that's a given. If we're able to reject the idea that a creator being is responsible for this, then it has to be that we are responsible for this. Our experience speaks for itself, and through careful analysis, we're able to totally reject the assertion that our world comes from an omniscient, omnipotent creator being. So the truth of Lord Buddha's teachings begins to resonate with us. All Buddhist schools accept the statement about karma, but they differ about how emptiness ties into karma and how the mind fits into the whole thing. You need to understand the views of the different schools in order to come to an understanding of karma and emptiness for yourself. ACI Course 5 is about karma, and ACI Course 6 is about emptiness, and ACI Course 15 talks about some of the different views of emptiness in the different schools. But it's also the case that all of the courses talk about emptiness to some degree, And all of them really talk about karma to some degree also. That's the class for today. And now we have some time for questions. Or maybe not.
I now understood which lines are referenced in the homework, because it's referenced the line from the Abhidharma Kosha, and it's not in the reading, it's in the class notes.
Right.
Okay, so I understood that.
Okay.
Has that got everybody which two lines we need to memorize from the homework?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Lili Jikta, that's okay. That was my memory.
Okay, Venerable Silla, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And we try to think about our imagination of our God and to prove it or not to prove it.
It takes several years to really get a good grasp. I mean, before to show up next week, you could probably tell me all this, right?
Mm. Okay, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, keep your mind, evaluate your experience.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Venerable Phil. Have a nice day.
Thank you
very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, you all.
Bye, you all.